Today, the aftershocks reverberate. The DFA Daily is the 29th of April 2020. Hello again, I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to the latest post covering finance and problem news with a distinctively Australian flavour. The economic impacts of the virus shock are occurring faster than they did during the Great Depression, and Australia may not ever return to business as usual, according to Treasury Secretary Stephen Kennedy. New real-time ABS data shows that employment in accommodation and food services and arts and recreation services fell by 25.6% and 18.7% respectively over the 3 weeks from the 14th of March to the 4th of April. Unemployment is now expected to rise to 10%. Unemployment rose to higher levels in the Great Depression, but it did that over the course of a couple of years, Mr. Kennedy told the Select Committee on COVID-19. These movements are happening in just a couple of months. We have never seen an economic shock of this speed, magnitude, and shape, reflecting that this is both a significant supply and demand shock. While the final shape of that shock remains hard to predict, Mr. Kennedy anticipates that economic activity will resume as uncertainty around the virus diminishes, but the nature of the Australian economy could well change even as it returns to business as usual. New challenges will have emerged, Mr. Kennedy said. Some jobs and businesses will have been lost permanently. The Treasury will increasingly turn to these challenges, continue to advise on policy settings and reforms that will enable our country to prosper in a world that in many ways will look largely the same but may have also changed in some important ways. The government has so far unleashed $320 billion in stimulus spending, equating to around 10% of GDP. That's larger than any support package provided by an Australian government in the past 50 years. $10 billion have been distributed over the past 3 weeks, and around three times that will be expected in the next month. Australian governments have substantially lessened the economic impact of the social distancing measures by acting decisively and early, Mr. Kennedy said. They have collectively taken a balanced approach to preventing activities likely to spread the virus, while allowing other activities to continue where possible. This has meant that in Australia, we've been able to continue a wider range of economic activities, such as construction, manufacturing, and mining. While the high degree of uncertainty has delayed the 2021 budget until the 6th of October, Treasurer Josh Frydenberg will provide a statement to the House of Representatives and the Minister for Finance on the 12th of May, outlining the impact of the virus on the economy and the government's actions. And the government will also provide an economic update on the economic and fiscal outlook in June, following the release of the March quarter national accounts. Now, James McIntyre, Bloomberg's economics economist, covering the Australian and New Zealand economies, wrote an important piece where he argues that while Australia appears to have succeeded in flattening the coronavirus curve, such an optimistic health outcome won't prevent the economy from experiencing a deep downturn. Our base case, he says, anticipates the largest contraction since the 1930-31 Great Depression. Significant stimulus, both monetary and fiscal, is cushioning households and helping businesses to survive and retain workers. Despite this, Australia's small open economy has already seen considerable damage and faces headwinds from subdued global demand and trade. Significant monetary fiscal coordination to provide further stimulus will be required to recover the economy over the years ahead. We anticipate three consecutive quarters of declining gross domestic product, with Australia's economy contracted by 9% from the fourth quarter 2019 before a gradual recovery begins in the fourth quarter of 2020. And he says, we do not expect a recovery to pre-outbreak levels of activity until the second half of 2022. For 2020, our base case estimate remains a 6% contraction, unchanged from our previous projection. The better-than-expected virus containment would boost 2021 growth from 1.6% to 2.5%. A potential second wave of outbreak remains the main downside risk. Monetary policy has shifted to support fiscal policy and foster financial stability. The overnight cash rate is expected to remain on hold through to at least 2022, with ongoing quantitative easing to contain yields amid rising issuance as fiscal packages and automatic stabilizers kick in. How far the unemployment rate rises depends on participation trends. Labour market slack is set to linger for years, which will depress wages growth and inflation. And Australia's apparent success in containing the coronavirus outbreak has paved the way for the economy to emerge early from an economic hibernation that was anticipated to last for 6 months. But this process is likely to be gradual and won't prevent a significant economic downturn. Compared to our previous forecast, what has changed is the extent and timing of the hit to the economy from measures taken to confront the health crisis. There has been a significant pull forward of retail spending in the first quarter 2020. This will weigh on consumer spending in the second quarter 2020, creating a deeper contraction then. There is a non-trivial risk that the shopping splurge prevents Australia's economy from contracting in the first quarter, though we think this is unlikely given the possible declines in non-retail sectors of household consumption and the broader economic activity. We are now less confident in seeing the contraction in activity persisting through the third quarter 2020. We currently anticipate a small fall in third quarter GDP, though this is highly dependent on how virus restrictions are unwound. The lifting of restrictions will enable businesses to restart, but stoking demand may not be as easy given hits to household and business confidence and damage to balance sheets. Resumption of economic activity will also be accompanied by some unwinding of temporary fiscal measures, which could dampen incomes and demand. As a small open economy, the weak global economic backdrop may also constrain Australia's economic recovery. Further risks of a second wave of outbreak, most likely imported, mean that restrictions on international travel are unlikely to be eased promptly. While Australia's international borders will be kept closed for a further 3 to 4 months, the potential loosening of movement restrictions within virus-free zones, such as with New Zealand, does present an upside risk to the outlook. And preliminary estimates from the labour market confirm that containing the virus has come at a great cost. Despite the substantial fiscal response, the grim reality is that not all businesses and jobs will be saved. Fiscal policy will need to pivot from economic survival to stimulus and recovery as the virus gets under control. The overhang in the labour market is likely to be more pronounced than traditional headline indicators suggest. Our forecast incorporates a sharp rise in the unemployment rate, but even still, the true picture of the shedding in labour demand or degree of excess labour supply is likely to be obscured by declines in participation and reductions in hours per employee. As assistance payments taper and social distancing measures are gradually wound back, labour force participation and subsequently the unemployment rate is likely to rise. The significant dislocation within the labour market will probably linger for an extended period, even though economic growth may bounce back. The economy will have to run hot or above potential for an extended period to not only re-engage unemployed workers, but to absorb underlying growth in labour supply. This will weigh on already depressed wage growth for an extended period, and in turn, prospects for wage-driven inflationary pressures are dim. Firms are unlikely to face a demand environment that's conducive to lifting prices for some time. And this will in part be compounded by households seeking to rebuild wealth through boosting savings, which risks postponing or muting the demand-led recovery. On balance, these forces mean monetary policy will remain accommodative for an extended period in coordination with fiscal policy, and the stronger and more sustained the fiscal response, the faster economies will be able to heal. And there are upside and downside risks to our outlook. Effective policy support in Australia, China and the rest of the world could help the economy stage a stronger rebound. But the downside risks are considerable. Another flare-up of COVID-19 cases domestically could lead to Australia reinstituting another lockdown. Even assuming more moderate containment measures, the result would be a double dip for Australia's growth rate. And we estimate that a second outbreak would prompt a contraction of around 3% in the fourth quarter 2020 and lead to a contraction of 2.1% in 2021. The extent of any scarring, Even after a better-than-expected resumption of activity and significant government efforts, the lingering damage to the economy may prove greater than we had assumed, and damaged households and balance sheets could crimp activity, resulting in a longer-than-expected recovery. On the upside, Australia could experience a better-than-expected containment and recovery, and this could be further boosted by potential twinning of Australia's economy with New Zealand's, which has experienced similar success in controlling the outbreak, the establishment of a trans-Tasman bubble, which might experience more relaxed movement of people and activity, could result in a stronger and earlier recovery for both economies. And Gareth Aird, the senior economist at CBA, says the spending shock underway in the economy right now is being picked up well by the CBA credit and debit card data. But analysis from payments into CBA's bank accounts paints a very different picture with regard to the impact that the enforced shutdown is having on household income. Our data, he says, indicates that at an aggregate level, the reduction in household income from job losses to date has been more than offset by an increase in government benefit payments. Indeed, the annual growth rate in our partial return on household income that comprises wages and salaries plus government benefits paid has risen over April. Our wages and salaries data captures all wages and salaries paid into CBA bank accounts. In essence, it's picking up changes in the level of employment, wages growth, and hours worked. It indicates that total wages and salaries are running at around 5% over the year, over the early part of 2020, very similar to the national account measure of compensation for employees, which is around 4.8% in the fourth quarter 19. That rate of growth dropped sharply by mid-April to around 3% over the year, but has since recovered to sit flat over the year. We suspect that there is a bit of noise in the data because of the timing of Easter. Included in wages and salaries paid will be people who have lost their jobs but have continued to receive some form of payment from their employer due to their contractual arrangements, for example, 4 weeks paid notice on termination, leave paid, etc. So there will be a lag between job losses and the full impact on the total wages and salaries bill. Notwithstanding, our data gives us an early guide to what's happening from an employee earnings perspective. Note that going forward, JobKeeper payments, which are not yet flowing, will be captured as salary and wages in our data because JobKeeper is paid to employees via their employers. Government benefits paid into CBA bank accounts have surged over the past month. There has been a 50% increase in the number of bank accounts receiving JobSeeker, and the first tranche of the $750 cash payments to 6.5 million Australians has been paid. The net result has seen total government benefits paid rise by 60% over the year as of late April. And this does not take into account the doubling in JobSeeker, which takes effect from the 27th of April. Combining wages and salaries paid into CBA bank accounts with government benefits also paid into CBA bank accounts gives us a partial read on household income. It excludes rents, interest earned, dividends, and a few other things. Our data indicates that on this measure alone, the size of the increase in government benefits paid has been bigger than the drop in wages and salaries paid to date. The net result has seen growth in household income rise. Our data highlights the profound impact that fiscal stimulus has had on the household sector. As we've argued previously, monetary and fiscal stimulus can't boost spending in the economy on a range of goods and services when businesses that produce them are not open. But fiscal stimulus can help to plug the gap in household income. This is a natural consequence of job losses. Our data indicates that the savings rate will surge over the second quarter 2020 as the shock to spending dwarfs the shock to income. That might be just as well given the latest from the ABS. They reported a rise of 0.3% in the March 2020 quarter consumption price index, reflecting the impact of the drought and bushfires on some food prices and the early effects of the virus, according to the latest Australian Bureau of Statistics. The most significant price rises in the March 2020 quarter were for food and non-alcoholic beverages up 1.9%, alcohol and tobacco up 1.6%, education up 2.6%, and health up 1.7%. The most significant price falls for the quarter were for automotive fuel down 6%, domestic holiday travel and accommodation down 3.1%, and international holiday travel and accommodation down 3%. Drought and bushfire-related effects impacted prices for a range of food products. Prices rose in the March 2020 quarter for fruit and vegetables, up 6%, and meat and seafood up 2%. There was some price effects of the COVID-19 apparent in the March quarter due to higher purchases of certain products towards the end of the quarter as restrictions came into effect. Most noticeably, rises were seen in other non-durable household products up 3.4%, which includes toilet paper, personal care products up 2.2%, which includes soap and hand sanitizer, and other cereal products, which is up 4.4%, which includes rice and pasta. More evident effects of COVID-19 are expected in the June quarter CPI. And as a result, annual inflation rose 2.2% in the March 2020 quarter and is the highest since September 2014 quarter. Now, Louis Christopher, the CEO of SQM, wrote that he has been reading with interest how some are downplaying the current low auction clearance rates due to the current forced ban on public auctions. The argument is that sales activity is still occurring and or that the market is in hibernation. SQM Research has been monitoring all scheduled auctions, and it's clear that those properties that have been re-advertised as private treaty have largely not sold. If there were plenty of buyers in the market, more of these properties would have sold by now, but they haven't. The properties are just sitting there. So he says, our opinion of the market is, at currently sits, there's been a significant drop in buyer activity since mid-March, as the auction clearance rates accurately reveal. We hold to the view that pricing expectations have adjusted in the capital cities of Sydney, Melbourne and Brisbane, between 5 and 10% from their February highs. However, it's also fair to say that the market has not yet collapsed. There was a surge in sellers in the lead-up to the crisis, many of them no doubt trying to capture the February high of the market before things deteriorated. Most sellers didn't make it in time. But since then, those sellers have not outright panicked just yet. And with the flagging of the easing of restrictions across the states, many of them will be hoping that buyer activity will pick up again shortly. Hope is, of course, the operative word, as it is still not clear exactly when businesses will return to a sense of normality. When will a physical public auction be allowed? When will the bars and restaurants open? When will it be okay to book a trip? When will the borders open once again? It's amusing, he says, to see some of the more optimistic commentators scoff at our more negative scenario, yet in almost the same breath, plead with our government to immediately ease restrictions. All the same, since we wrote our outlook back in early April, we said the next 30 days may tell the story. And since that time, it does appear that the probabilities of the easing of business restrictions in May have risen. And so it follows that the probability of a V-shaped recovery flagged in our 7th of April newsletter in the housing market has also risen. The market will still need to deal with a massive burgeoning hole in underlying demand this year, which is a result of the freeze-up in net migration. And he said, I'm conservatively expecting a surplus of well over 120,000 properties remaining unoccupied and looking for an occupier this year if net migration continues to be frozen for most of 2020. That is going to be one major hangover for the housing market, particularly for the rental market. Indeed, we are now already recording a surge in rental listings. This will no doubt mean a large rise in April vacancy rates will be recorded. And note, we're also recording falls in asking rents for each of the capital cities, some of them rather large falls. So while the probabilities have moved more towards a V-shaped recovery, the risks remain in the housing market. And one of the things we're seeing a lot of is government intervention at the moment. And here's another example. The freedom of Victorian tenants to choose where they live could be substantially restricted under the new COVID-19 laws. Legislation that cleared State Parliament last week to combat the effects of the virus on the state economy now requires renters on month-on-month leases to get a Victorian Civil and Administrative Tribunal order if they want to move out. At the tribunal, they would need to prove severe hardship if they were made to stay put. The temporary law is a significant departure from the original one requiring the tenant to provide 28 days written notice before leaving. No reason needed. Human rights organisation Liberty Victoria says the change is unprecedented. It puts so much more power in the hands of the landlord. The emergency laws are effective for the next 6 months. And from the AFR, banking analysts fear that if the COVID-19 crisis worsens, the cost to the big banks of bankrolling Team Australia could exceed the $10 billion estimated for this year and $35 billion over 3 years. Many business customers stung by the economic shutdown are expected to struggle to repay debts when the six-month loan deferrals negotiated by the banks and the Morrison government expire. Bank chiefs concede some of these customers may not survive the crisis. If the banks book similar related impairments in the second half of the year, the Big Four could take a $10 billion bullet for the economy this year. Similarly, large hits may follow in each of the next 2 years. Morgan Stanley analyst Richard Wiles forecasts cumulative losses of $35.4 billion for the major banks over the next 3 years, which would represent 120 basis points of total loans. And on bank behaviour, the ACCC has confirmed major banks clawed in millions from a delay between mortgage rate cut announcement and effective dates. Findings contained in their interim home loan price inquiry report, which examines how the Big Four ANZ, CBA, NAB and Westpac home loan pricing behaviour between the 1st of January 2019 and the 31st of October 2019. The report was commissioned following criticism of the banks from Treasurer Josh Frydenberg for their failure to pass on the RBA's full 25 basis point cuts to the cash rate in October 2019. The ACCC has found that the Big Four banks received additional revenue from the lag period between interest rate cut announcements made following cash rate reductions and the effective date of such changes, according to the competition watchdog. While each of the Big Four banks announced their rate changes on the day or the day after the RBA's cash rate decision, headline variable interest rate changes came into effect 9 to 21 days after the announcement. The CBA was singled out by the ACCC, which claimed it had a significantly longer lag period than its peers following each of its headline variable rate changes in June, July and October 2019. The CBA informed the ACCC that they did receive some additional revenue from this delay. And in fact, CBA acknowledged that extended revenue gains formed part of its decision to set a commencement date for the mortgage reduction rate. ANZ, NAB and Westpac denied that additional revenue from the lag period was part of their consideration, instead claiming that they needed sufficient time to implement the required business and operational changes that follow a change in the headline variable rate. However, the ACCC has acknowledged that the increase in revenue may have been partially offset by higher costs incurred from interest paid to depositors during the lag period in instances where mortgage rate cuts and deposit rate changes came into effect at the same time. Moreover, the ACCC noted that the major banks had lag periods of up to 28 days for headline variable rate increases in 2018 in response to rising wholesale funding costs, which would have led to a decrease in home loan revenue. And the ACCC's final report, which will examine the impediment to home loan switching and provide recommendations, was due to be released in September. However, in the light of the pandemic, the federal government has announced that it will be postponed until the 30th of November 2020. Now, according to Domain, first-time home buyers continue to access the Morrison government's deposit subsidy scheme, which was launched in January and allows first home buyers to purchase a property with just a 5% deposit. Of the 10,000 places available, the latest statistics from Federal Minister for Housing Michael Sukkar show that nationally 4,147 certificates have been issued for those who have already bought a property, and a further 3,909 places are on hold waiting for the purchase of a property, whilst only 1,944 places are still available. My recommendation is to be very cautious with properties expected to drop in value over the next 6 months and perhaps for even longer. That means you could be borrowing more than what the house is worth. But Commonwealth Bank said 1,000 Australians have now purchased a property under the Australian government's first home loan deposit scheme with them, and they've helped a further 2,400 customers secure a place under the scheme. And CBA can now extend the deadline to find a property and enter a contract of sale for a further 90 days. This will give customers a total of 6 months to find a property and provide them with the peace of mind they need during this difficult period that their place under the scheme is safe. CBA Group Executive Retail Banking Services Angus Sullivan said, there is a lot of interest and uncertainty about the impact the virus will have on the Australian property market. So it's encouraging that we've crossed this exciting milestone in the current environment. And the ABA said Australian banks will issue a record number of debit cards, either MasterCard or Visa card, to customers who don't have them and who may be self-isolating to make sure they can continue to pay for their goods and services online or over the phone throughout the pandemic. Currently, they say, there are over 500,000 Australian bank customers who actively use a passbook account or transaction account with no linked debit card. With many of those being customers over 70 years of age, this means they pay for goods and services using cash or FPOS, but are unable to shop online or over the phone. Government advice is that Australians who are over 70 should stay at home whenever possible during the pandemic. In addition to this, many retailers are not accepting cash at this time due to concerns over it being a potential vehicle for the spread of the virus. Over the next few weeks, banks will be sending out cards or contacting customers directly. Those people receiving cards are under no obligation to activate them or use them, and banks are offering them to ensure that these customers have the option to use a card if they're isolating or in quarantine. Australian Banking Association CEO Anna Bligh said the industry has recognised that as a result of the government's social distancing advice, particularly for older Australians, we must provide additional options for people to do their banking and pay for goods and services. It might surprise some in the community that there are many thousands of customers who are still using a passbook or savings and cheque account that have no debit card. We understand that some people who haven't used a debit card in the past may have concerns over safety and security. However, they should be rest assured that it's safe, it's secure, and you can track your spending. The industry thanks the regulator, in particular ASIC, who has provided the approvals needed on this record-breaking project quickly and efficiently, she said. These cards will incur no additional cost to any customer, and bank staff will be on hand to provide practical advice to those unfamiliar with how these cards work. But of course, this is a little bit of the cash ban through the back door, insofar that handling cash costs a lot of money, and so if you can convince more people to use electronic means, you reduce the amount of cash in the system. And also, of course, as they say, transactions can be tracked, which means transactions can be tracked. Finally, the conversation said that governments are being asked to do the near impossible to deliver on both health and on the economy. The health objective is to minimise the number of lives lost and keep the spread of the virus low enough so as not to overwhelm the healthcare system. Relaxing of restrictions won't be anywhere near enough to restore the economy to its full health, though. Treasury Secretary Stephen Kennedy said the crisis was without precedent. Even if we lifted all of its restrictions right now, demand for our exports would remain at global recession levels, pushing our economy backwards. Adding to the case for enormous extra spending is the additional reality that business cycles are almost always asymmetric. The output loss in a recession isn't gained in the recovery. To allow a big recession is to permanently alter our standards of living and possibly our future growth path, all the more so in downturns caused by pandemics, which have been linked to a long-lasting increase in precautionary savings. Fortunately, fiscal stimulus has been shown to be its most effective when the economy is massively underutilising its resources, as it is now. The bridging measures undertaken by the government, including JobKeeper, will be critical for mitigating the severity of the recession and maintaining a platform for recovery. Even with them, it is entirely reasonable to expect the unemployment rate to climb into double digits as 15 to 20% of the workforce lose their jobs. Australia is in the fortunate position as our government went into the crisis with ample capacity to conduct large-scale fiscal stimulus, having one of the lowest net debt to GDP ratios in the developed world, just short of 20%. But the scale of the stimulus needed is huge, and it will be better to err on the high side, at least 15 to 20% of GDP per year for 2 to 3 years. Anything less runs the risk of a debt default deflationary spiral of the kind seen in the Great Depression, when the ability of households and businesses to pay their debts decreased with deflation and the resulting defaults led to further deflation. If stimulus is big enough to be successful, financial markets will understand that debt issued by the Commonwealth will ultimately be backed by a higher GDP. The early measures should focus on boosting the capacity of the economy to make it better able to withstand future pandemics. Examples include improving the national broadband network with a focus on reducing outages and building infrastructure that will allow homes to act as offices, especially in high-density areas. Or improving the ability of Australia Post to deliver physical items to households and the ability of ports and road transport to get things to where they're needed. Or again, building and encouraging the use of the robust technologies that will be needed to ensure keeping the spread of this virus and others low. Or again, labour-intensive programs that boost improved local environments, everything from tree planting and waterway cleanups to cycle path construction and dune repair. Or again, online delivery for universities, including investments in materials for overseas students who will be given a commitment to be allowed to travel to Australian campuses once restrictions are removed, and making Australia a world leader in the remote delivery of arts in a way that makes Australian culture available worldwide, and also a world leader in the local delivery of art via labour-intensive public art works. Now, in normal times, it might make sense to develop this infrastructure privately or through public-private partnerships. But in the present crisis, it can only be done publicly on the scale that is needed. The Australian government has the capacity to do it. The best way to make that clear would be a set of separate accounts for the emergency offset by the issuing of long-term COVID bonds at low interest rates, much like the war bonds Australia issued during the Second World War. The bonds would allow visibility into the extent to which the Commonwealth government remained prudent in other spending and would use a precedent already established in making a distinction between spending for investment and spending for consumption. A broad take-up could also engender the political support needed to extend JobKeeper to more than 1 million casual workers and temporary visa holders and students, denying people who could contribute to Australia's economic recovery the opportunity to do it risks denying Australia the resources it will need when the crisis is over. Announcing these programs as soon as possible and providing guidance on the scale and duration of the planned spending will help prevent future declines in economic activity right now. The government is delivering an economic statement in a fortnight on May the 12th, and they say it would be the right day to start. So once again, standing back, we can see that the uncertainty around the virus spills over into broader economic uncertainty. And almost every aspect of life, whether it be the financial system, whether it will be employment, whether it will be spending, are all being impacted by what's going on. But it's also important to think about crafting an exit strategy, economically speaking. And I think the concept of a COVID bond is something that really should be considered. After all, it has been proven before, and it would make some of this very vague funding much, much more transparent. But hey, I'm not sure this government is actually that interested in transparency at the best of times. So the COVID bond idea might make sense, but I have to say the list of ideas that they came up with in that article seemed to me to be anemic at best. There are some much more substantive issues that need to be invested in to lay the foundation for a better economic future for our country, and that ultimately must be focused on bringing manufacturing capability back on shore and laying a path towards a greener, more balanced economy. There is so much that could be done, but I wonder whether they will have the intestinal fortitude to run with it. I rather doubt it. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.